DW Deutsche Welle Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. On today's show, can a robot really stop loneliness for sick kids? We talk to a researcher behind a novel blood test that detects the early signs of Alzheimer's disease and... Today's secret sound, any ideas? Stay tuned as we bore down to the root of the problem. All that and more coming up on this jam-packed edition of Spectrum.
All I want to be some kind of friend.
A little robot that can speak and hear and who raises its head when you talk to it is breaking the isolation of hundreds of children who have to spend sometimes long periods away from school because of illness. It was invented and is most widely used in Norway. John Lorentzen headed to Sula, a small town outside Stavanger on Norway's western coastline, to meet one of the robots and its owner.
Hola, amigo.
Come on. Yeah. Julia.
Yeah. Hi.
Sat on her sofa at home, 15-year-old Julia Miller, her mum is Norwegian, her dad American, opens an application on her computer and switches on a little white robot that's on her desk at school. His head lifts and his eyes light up as she says hi to her classmates who are about to start their classes for the day.
I'm Julia. I'm into technological stuff. I like building things.
Your dad said, yeah.
Yeah, I like video games a lot on my computer, and I like art and drawing.
Julia has complex regional pain syndrome, or CRPS. It's a chronic condition caused by confused communication between the brain and the peripheral nervous system. The brain signals there's something terribly wrong, generating excruciating pain, when in fact there's nothing wrong. It started in her foot when she was 11 before spreading to her whole body when she was 12.
For about 2.5 years when I first got the sickness, I was home like 90% of the time. I was isolated. I could barely talk to my friends. I wasn't connected to any of the teachers, and I could barely do any schoolwork because I wouldn't know what I was going to do. With the AV1 robot, then I can participate in class, pay attention to what the teacher is saying, so I'm not just going by what says on the computer. I could be a part of group projects with my friends and stuff. You can talk and communicate, and you can push a button that's a light on top of the AV1 robot's head, so you can show that, like, you think you know the answer or you have a question. I can also turn the robot 360 degrees, like, all the way around, which is pretty cool. I like seeing, like, other classmates seeing their reaction when I move the head, and they're like, whoa. Then when I have a really bad day, then I don't always leave my bed or anything, and I can't always sit up, so I can lay in bed in my pajamas, and you can see on my face, like, I'm pale and I don't feel well at all. And nobody has to see that with a robot. I just see what's going on over there.
I saw a microphone. I thought it was you, but it was a different microphone. Welcome to Norway.
Thank you. In Oslo, I visit the company that makes the AV1. The company's called No Isolation. Its founding principle is to provide solutions for different forms of isolation. So its newest product, for example, is aimed at bringing screen-to-screen communication to digitally illiterate seniors. One of its founders, Anna Holmheider, says isolation is a big global problem, but one that's particularly acute in Norway because of the large distances, sparse population and harsh climate.
Over 7% of Europe's population consider themselves severe lonely. So no isolation is based on a very fundamental thought of helping people out of loneliness. So we want to build technology that will actually assist people in getting connected back to society and getting back into the greater community.
But are you solving the problem? You're not actually bringing people closer together physically.
Yeah, but technology is a great way to bring people together. And you have all these discussions that technology are bringing people apart, like it's creating distance. But I really think that we have to look at the possibilities that are given to us by technology. If you can be in the classroom, you see what's going on, you hear what's going on, you can keep track of who's dating who or what teacher is being really angry at times. Like, you want to be a part of your daily society, and technology makes it possible.
There are now over 400 of these robots in use, but the company says millions of children around the world miss months of school each year, so the scope for expansion is big. No Isolation believes it will have between 2,000 and 4,000 AV1s in operation by the end of this year. As for the cost, some are rented out at €2,000 a year, some sold to schools for €2,500 plus €100 monthly fee for 4G support and insurance. Quite a lot of money, perhaps, for what is quite a technologically simple device, but for people like Julia, it has been a life changer. This is her mother, Cecily.
The AV1 robot is something that I first saw come up on social media, and I was thinking, wow, what if my child could have one of those? And then when we actually got the opportunity for Julia to get one, sponsored through a foundation that works to end isolation for sick kids, I mean, the joy was through the roof. We were literally dancing around the living room at the opportunity of getting this robot. And it's just such an enormous change to have a child 2.5 years losing all her friends to now being able to not just follow school, but maintain friendships. And that's just been incredible.
Jeg skal skru av roboten nå. Ha det.
Å ja, ok, greit. Jamen, ha det.
John Lawrenson, DW, Sula, Norway.
From the moment you was dancing in the party, pushing out on me. Giving everything, you're giving everything tonight. And if you thought you could get away from me, get away from me. Girl, just take your time. You're coming on with me tonight. Girl, I got a question for you. Can I get an answer?
Edward Hernandez from San Salvador in El Salvador has written to us here at the Science Desk with a question. He wants to know, why is there water inside a coconut? Emma Wallace is here with the answer. Emma, over to you.
Getting at a coconut can be quite a challenge, even for the most agile of creatures. And it's equally hard to crack one. A coconut is classified as a stone fruit. It's made up of a tough outer skin which gives way to a fibrous husk. Then you get to the nut which surrounds the seed. Inside is the white flesh and the coconut water. Both nourish the seed until it germinates. One function of coconut water is to store nutrients. A single fruit contains about a litre of water. Coconut water shouldn't be confused with coconut milk, which is used in cooking. That's made out of the grated flesh of the coconut and regular water. There's no actual coconut water in it. And finally, the delicious fruit isn't just a thirst quencher. Coconut shell can be turned into charcoal briquettes. It burns longer than regular charcoal and doesn't produce smoke, so it is an eco-friendly alternative.
Girl, I got a question for you. Can I get an answer?
If you've got a question you'd like us to answer at the Science Desk, get in contact with us via email science@dw.com, Twitter @DW_SciTech, Facebook DW Science, or you can always write to me on Twitter @JessieWingard. Many of us are scared of needles and having our blood taken. But what if a simple blood test could predict your chances of developing neurological conditions well into the future? Well, scientists in Germany have now developed a blood test that does just that. Screening for Alzheimer's, the test can detect early indicators of the disease long before symptoms appear. Klaus Gerwert, a professor at Ruhr University Bochum in Germany, who led the research, joins me on the line. Professor Gerwert, welcome to Spectrum. To get our heads around how much of a big deal your find actually is, can you explain how people are currently diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, the first diagnosis is a test where you just look at the cognition, the ability to very simple questions, how old are you, in which city you are living. So it's a very unprecise test. It's called mini mental status test. And if people perform not very nicely in this mini mental status test, you can go further and you can do either take a liquor from the spinal cortex by lumbar puncture, or you can do PET scanning. So either it's very invasive or PET scanning is very cost intensive. So the current diagnostics are invasive and cost intensive.
You mentioned there the invasive ways of diagnosing Alzheimer's to date, but you've been looking at another way of testing for the disease. What have you and your team been up to?
There's a general agreement within the field that we need within the Alzheimer's disease a blood test by which you can non-invasively measure the quite objective the disease. So this is very important for the clinicians that they can diagnose the disease clear cut. And it's also general agreement that we need a very early diagnosis. So therefore, it's important to have a blood test which can identify very early people at high risk for Alzheimer's disease.
What is the blood test you and your team created able to show?
The blood test can show the distribution of the secondary structure of the A-beta peptide. And it's important that it shows a distribution because also healthy people have already a certain amount of misfolded A-beta peptide, a very small amount. And therefore, the test can distinguish between people which has a small amount of misfolded A-beta and people who have a large amount of the A-beta peptide. And it's very important that we can measure both forms and see the distribution. So this is a big advantage as compared to the tests which are so far on the market. The test on the market measures the ratio between A-beta 40 and A-beta 42. That means they have slightly different lengths. And you can measure, for example, by mass spectroscopy, the all A-beta which are the length 40 and which have the length 42. And the idea is that the A-beta 42 is aggregated in the brain and missing in the blood. So what you are measuring is a missing A-beta 42 in the blood. And this is somehow indirect measure, whereas our test measures directly the misfolding of the A-beta peptide. And that's an advantage because we measure direct the process which takes place at the beginning of the disease. It's not yet clear if this process causes the A-beta peptide or if just correlated to the disease. But for diagnosis, it doesn't matter. In both cases, you can use it as diagnostic tool. It's only important, or not only, it's important for therapy to know what causes the disease.
There's currently no cure for Alzheimer's, I understand. What benefits would an early diagnosis of Alzheimer's, say through the blood test you've been working on, have on patients?
You're right. There are no cure available for a normal person, but there are at least two studies in clinical phase 3, one of Biogen and one of Roche. And in this clinical phase 3, they test a drug. And if this drug will perform nicely, then they think that they can bring a drug within about 3 years on the market. But you are completely right. At the moment, the test is mostly for research to identify individuals very early for clinical studies. And this is very important for the clinical studies, that you identify the people quite early to develop new therapies.
Are there plans to extend the test to include other neurological diseases, perhaps like Parkinson's disease?
Yes. I mean, the test works in a way that we used an antibody. This is we called it the immuno-infrared sensor. The immuno part is the antibody. The antibody extracts a specific protein, in case of Alzheimer's disease, the A-beta protein, and then the healthy form and the diseased form is bound. And the infrared can measure the distribution of the secondary structure of the, so how much healthy and how much diseased beta peptides are there. And if it's below a threshold, the distribution, then we know it's Alzheimer. And the distribution is shifted further down in the frequency and more clearly separated as far as the disease progresses. So if we think now on Parkinson, there is a protein called alpha-synuclein, which plays a similar role as the beta peptide in Alzheimer's disease. And we are also working hard to find an antibody which can bind also all forms of alpha-synuclein, the alpha helical, the random coil, and the beta sheet forms. And then we are quite confident that we can develop also a test for Parkinson's disease. So at the end of the day, we will have a test which measures the beta peptide, the tau protein, and the alpha-synuclein.
Klaus Gerwert, professor at Ruhr University Bochum in Germany, who's been working on a blood test to detect Alzheimer's disease years before symptoms appear. Thank you so much for joining me on the program today.
Okay, you're very welcome.
Driving home, raindrops falling down out of the blue.
The Persian Gulf region is one of the hottest and driest areas on the Earth. Scientists have warned that if global temperatures continue to rise, the region could become uninhabitable within just 50 years. One of the main challenges is to secure a supply of drinking water. At the moment, that involves the burning of fossil fuels. But the United Arab Emirates, where per capita CO2 emissions are among the world's highest, are looking to change their ways. The rulers have lofty ambitions for ensuring their people can live on in the Gulf for centuries to come. From Dubai, Andrew Connolly has the story.
Old wooden Abras ferry passengers and cargo up and down the harbour in Dubai's Old Town. For centuries, these warm, shallow waters supported Dubai's modest fishing and pearling industries when it was just a desert village without running water. Then in the 1950s, the United Arab Emirates struck oil, sparking Dubai's transformation into a land of the highest skyscrapers and the largest malls in the world, complete with indoor ski slopes. Dubai's thirst for water continues to grow with its population of 3 million. But its method for securing water through desalination produces large amounts of CO2 emissions. The rulers of Dubai, however, want to change this. By the year 2050, their aim is to have 75% of the city's power come from clean energy resources. So how does the thirst to quench one of the driest regions on Earth tally with the country's aims to tackle climate change? Dubai gets most of its water through desalination, extracting the salt from seawater and gas-fired plants to make it potable, a process both expensive and energy-intensive. Emirati Minister for Climate Change, Thani Ahmed Al-Zayoudi, insists his government is moving towards water sustainability.
Decades ago, everyone, the world were laughing at us at this region, that we are drinking the seawater. But now it's becoming the only solution to fight against the droughts, which goes around the world. And this is what we took seriously here. What we're doing now, we're testing the usage of renewable energy in desalinations. So we're not only improving the efficiency of the existing technologies, we're investing in the future technologies.
The Jebel Ali water desalination plant in Dubai is a sprawling complex of twisting pipes emitting steam. Every day, millions of gallons of seawater from the Persian Gulf is boiled, filtered and treated here and turned into drinkable water. Yahya Al-Zafin, a vice president at DEWA, Dubai's Electricity and Water Authority, says that by 2030, 100% of water production in his plant will be powered by renewables. Solar, reverse osmosis filtering, and using waste heat to evaporate water are all methods being developed.
We started industrial water production in 78, is the farthest station to this side. And this, I understand now you are in the biggest desalination complex on Earth. Okay? And if someone asks you, oh, these people in this part of the world, they are burning fuel, fossil, they are ruining the environment, this is incorrect. This is our only source. And yes, we ensure that we use it wisely and with minimum impact on the environment.
In recent years, far-fetched ideas have emerged on how to address Dubai's water issue, from towing icebergs from the Antarctic or building an artificial mountain to increase cloud production. Cloud seeding technology, the dispersing of chemicals into the clouds by plane to stimulate rainfall, is already being carried out in Dubai's skies. The process has its skeptics, among them head of the United Nations Development Programme, Achim Steiner.
Now, when it comes to, you know, technologies or hypotheses about cloud seeding, I remain a little bit doubtful. I mean, certainly there are examples where, you know, this may work and can work. But I think the solution to humanity's resource dilemmas with soon 8, 9, 10 billion people cannot be to somehow manage the planet's life support systems like a chemical laboratory.
But on Dubai's ambitious plans for a green economy, Steiner is cautiously optimistic.
To turn to technology options such as desalination is not really a matter of choice, it's a matter of necessity. The question is, what do you then do? Do you build an economy on, you know, cheap oil, cheap gas that can make it possible to produce endless amounts of water, or do you begin to invest in, you know, water efficiency? Is an economy such as the UAE going to abandon its use of fossil fuels because it is at the moment the backbone of a significant part of the economy? Not yet, but I think moving both by example and by supporting economic transitions to a low-carbon economy is a critical part of helping the world move forward.
Making rain in the desert. Can a megacity synonymous with waste in excess really act as a benefactor for tiny climate change-affected nations? Not everyone seems convinced. Meanwhile, scientists warn that if global temperatures continue to rise, the Gulf region will be uninhabitable in just 50 years. But for now, Dubai's rulers remain hopeful that it's not too late to stem the tide. Andrew Connolly for DW in Dubai.
There's that secret sound again, and it's finally time to find out what it is. Did you guess it? It's a dentist's drill. And the ancient practice of hypnosis means it might not bother you quite as much as it once did. Hypnosis, a term originating from the Greek word hypnos, means sleep, and it has quite a long history. It's believed the practice was carried out in ancient times as a way to avoid pain, a kind of anaesthetic, if you will. Today, the practice is making a comeback in Germany, particularly among dentists, as an alternative to conventional sedation. Tony Andrews visited a dental clinic in Berlin practicing hypnosis amongst its patients to get a sense of exactly what's behind the ancient method.
Dr. Elisabeth von Maczynski's dental surgery in Berlin, Germany might look like your standard practice with drills and white lights, but there's one significant difference. When it comes to treatments to numb the pain, Dr. von Maczynski doesn't just offer standard run-of-the-mill anesthetic, she also offers hypnosis.
Using hypnosis as a method to combat pain is one of its oldest applications. Long before we had ether or chloroform, we used hypnosis as an analgesic.
Though the practice of hypnotherapy is centuries old, it's only gained popularity in Germany over the past three decades. For Dr. von Maczynski, the reason for its revival is obvious. Hypnosis allows patients to sidestep pain without resorting to chemicals.
Was bewirkt die Hypnose? Die kann tatsächlich diesen Schmerz.
What does hypnosis achieve? It can actually change the way we feel pain. That can happen because, though the pain signals actually arrive in the brain, changes take place on a neurological level so that we hardly feel the pain, if at all.
My name is Gerd Rieger.
Gerd Rieger has come in today to have a new crown fitted.
Are you in any way afraid right now? Yes, a little bit afraid of pain.
The consultation begins with Dr. von Maczynski lulling him into a trance.
Close your eyes, focusing on your breathing and concentration. Begin to go inside yourself.
While in a trance-like state, Dr. von Maczynski asks Gerd to raise his left hand if he feels any pain.
Und dein Unterbewusstsein hat bereits vom letzten Mal gespeichert.
Your subconscious already learned in our last session that it can give me signals. Signals that the trance is beginning. So when your hand lifts now, then that is a sign to us that your unconscious mind is leading you into a trance.
Scraping, pulling and even drilling, Dr. von Mazinski goes about her work seemingly without any restraint. After about 30 minutes, it's all over.
3, 2, 1. Open your eyes.
Counting down, she brings Gerd back to full consciousness. So, what's it like to be put in a trance?
She gives me some words and I look at the words and then I think what kind of pictures come up in this moment. And then very, very quickly, I start to think about a place away from here.
Okay, and what was the place for you?
Beach, Thailand.
Have you been to that beach, yeah, or was it just a perfect
no,
beach here?
No, I have been there, yes.
And it was a happy beach?
It's a happy beach, like probably most of the beaches are. It's warm, it smells well, and you lay down a little bit like here, so there are some similar feelings. But I'm not here at this moment.
What is happening is that the unconscious mind is overriding the physical impulses, says Dr. von Mazinski.
We know Hypnos was the Greek god for sleep, but sleep and hypnosis refer to different states of consciousness. Generally, we are not aware of our state of mind while we are sleeping. But a hypnotized patient, for example, knows where he is. He could even interrupt the session if he wanted to, but generally he's too comfortable or relaxed to do so.
The pain is essentially overruled by commands from the unconscious mind.
Neurobiologically speaking, you could imagine that the nerves simply stop communicating with each other.
From Gerd's perspective, he says he did feel some pain, but he chose to reinterpret the pain in his dream world, so it never became a reality.
I didn't want to feel the pain. Therefore, I found a way to reframe it as a color, in this case, and then I went back to the beach.
Okay, so the pain was there, but you decided to reframe it and move on.
Reframe it, and it was not a strong pain. It was just a little irritation from my sitting on the beach that brought me back.
It should be said that not everyone is able to get the same pain relief from hypnosis, but it is possible to train or practice going into a trance-like state.
Statistically, 10% of people go into trances particularly well. 80% have an average capacity, and 10% are less susceptible to falling into a trance. If someone wants to go into a trance, he can do it, but it will happen differently for everyone.
Sehr, sehr unterschiedlich, jeder auf seine Weise.
Dr. Albrecht Schmierer, founder of the German Hypnosis Society, says the value of dental hypnosis goes beyond the alleviation of pain. It also makes patients calmer during the consultation and therefore easier to treat.
We have a lot of patients who haven't been to a dentist for many, many years. And that's wonderful to help them with hypnosis because normally after one hypnosis, they are ready for dental treatment.
As a result, he says more than 5,000 dentists use hypnosis every day in their practices in Germany.
Hypnosis is a win-win system. The patient likes to be relaxed and to be treated gentle, and the dentist likes to treat in a totally calm atmosphere.
If that trend continues, perhaps one day soon hypnosis may become as common as laughing gas to ward off pain in the dentist's chair. For DW in Berlin, Germany, I'm Tony Andrews.
And it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spectrum. We'll be back next week with another packed edition of the show. But meanwhile, you can keep up to date with all things happening in the science and technology world by checking us out on Twitter at DW_SciTech, Facebook, DW Science, or online, dw.com www.hypnosisforward/science. I'm Jessie Wingard. On Twitter, you can find me at Jessie Wingard, and I'd love to hear from you. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead. It's all electric when I'm with you.